everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Ari Ariel, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Mark Wagner about his new book, Jews and Islamic Law in Early 20th Century Yemen. Professor Wagner is an associate professor in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures at Louisiana State University. Mark, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I wonder if you could begin just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I am from the Chicago area, and when I was in college at Vassar College in the Hudson Valley, I became interested in Jewish studies, but also in the study of the Middle East, and particularly intrigued in the ways in which these two fields overlapped and complemented one another. And so as I started to think about focusing more narrowly in graduate studies, I was naturally drawn to Muslim Spain, Al-Andalus, and the famous productive symbiosis that existed between Arabic and Hebrew literatures there. But I became gradually more intrigued by Yemen, which, as you know, also had a very substantial Jewish community that that had been there for hundreds of years, and Yemen was a place that had only recently become open in some ways to researchers. So in a sense, it was like one could throw a stone in any direction and find something new and that hadn't been dealt with at great length. Of course, at the same time, there is within Jewish studies, there is quite a depth of research on Yemen's Jewish community. So this book is something that came about. I did my dissertation research in my first book on literature, on a certain type of poetry that was written in partially or entirely in the vernacular Arabic of Yemen and was shared between Muslims and Jews. And in the course of doing that research, I came across a couple of books in most research libraries, sort of hiding in plain sight in the History of the Jews of Yemen section of the bookshelf, which were books in Hebrew with very boring titles like The Synagogues of Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and the poll tax in Yemen. And they were written by somebody named Shalom Sa'adia Gamliel, or Salem Sa'id al-Jamal in Arabic, and essentially published in his house on the basis of documents that he collected when he lived in Yemen in the first half of the 20th century. And so as I started to explore these books, I became aware of that it was really the tip of a much larger iceberg of a kind of what's essentially a lost world of Jewish and Muslim interaction in Yemen as portrayed in the memoirs of Jews who emigrated to Israel. And also in memoirs by Muslims in Yemen, written in Arabic and other types of sources like legal manuals and histories and things like that.
So a lot of the book is focused on the legal system. And I'm just wondering for listeners who are not familiar, could you give us maybe a general background on that legal system in Yemen?
Sure. Well, the time period that I deal with in the book in the first half of the 20th century is really coming on the cusp of some serious changes within the legal system. So there are certain factors within the legal system that show continuity even over a very long period of time, and others which are quite new. So the Ottomans have just been faced essentially a successful Arab revolt against their rule in Yemen, and Imam Yahya, who is the Zaydi Imam, who is central figure in the Arab the local Arab self-definition and is attempting to purge the legal system of a lot of the innovations that he and his constituents see as having been introduced under the Ottomans. That is a lot of certain attempts to be more lenient in certain areas, and also to introduce because the Ottomans followed the Hanafi madhab, which is one of the schools of legal interpretation in Sunni Islam, and they differ with the Zaydis. Zaydis are Shiites, and they are the majority in that northern part of Yemen. So there is an attempt to sort of bring back into existence a more strict Zaydi version of Islamic law, and also to disseminate that version of Islamic law throughout the country by means of new cadre of educated judges, judges who are educated in a certain way, and will take that legal system all over the country. And this, when it comes to the Jews, because of this, you see a sort of, it's relevant to the situation of the Jews in that you had some, not although not to the same extent as other parts of the empire, but you did have some attempts on the part of the Ottomans to sort of ease up on some of the sumptuary restrictions and different types of discriminatory legislation that Jews faced in different Muslim countries. And so those attempts were met with a lot of opposition. And so when Imam Yahya took over in the early part of the 20th century, there was a real rollback of I would say minority rights when it came. And Jews were the preeminent minority in Yemen. So and that kind of trauma of now having to make the case for having expanded rights or more opportunities within this very conservative system had some very shattering effects on the Jewish community itself, and effects that are still, I think, relevant today.
There's still a bit of a burgeoning literature about Jews and autonomy and Jewish courts in the Muslim world. So just to clarify, Jews then did use the Islamic courts in Yemen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a famous sort of admonition against Jews using Gentile courts that comes through in various places in rabbinic literature. But, you know, it's the same way that you find in medieval monastic literature is full of very detailed discussions of the punishment of homosexuals, not because there was no homosexuality in the monasteries, but just precisely because there was. So all over the Middle East, not only in Yemen, but Jews were using Muslim courts for a variety of reasons. When it came to property disputes, the Muslim court would offer, if you're in some sort of legal dispute involving your house, you want to go to the court that's going to give you the best written record, and so on. So it's something that we need not sentimentalize, but I think it was very clear to Jews living in the Islamic world, broadly speaking, that the Muslim courts being the courts that enforced the law of the land, they had a certain power that the Jewish courts did not. And so there was a constant kind of give and take between the two legal systems. And in some sense, in some spheres, such as in matrimonial law, divorce and things like that, litigants really had to use both systems in order to, for example, get a divorce.
So I guess this brings us more firmly into the territory of the book, and you say you're going to focus the book, or maybe focus is too strong a word, but a lot of the book revolves around three protagonists who all happen to have been intermediaries, sometimes in these courts, between members of the Jewish community and the Muslim authorities. Could you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, so one of them is Salem Saeed al-Jamal, who died in 2001. And he was it was Salem Saeed al-Jamal, Saleh al-Dahari, and Salem Mansura, all of whom died in the right around the turn of the 21st century. Right, so these three men had certain things in common. They were all well off and members of a kind of burgeoning mercantile elite that emerged in Yemen around the turn of the century, with the Ottomans allowing for imports. They were kind of a new class of import exporters, which specifically rose up within the Jewish community. They also knew Arabic quite a bit better than most Jews did, and most Jews, of course, would spoke Arabic on a daily basis. It was their vernacular. Arabic was their native language, but were functionally illiterate, like most Muslims, presumably. But they these men, through various ways, actually learned literary Arabic quite well, and had a good familiarity with the idioms and formulae of Islamic courts. So they were able to essentially function as lawyers within these courts, even though there is officially no such thing as a lawyer within Islamic law. And they also belong to a certain ideological orientation within Judaism in Yemen, which was a movement called Dor Da'ah, or the Enlightened Generation, that emerged right around the turn of the 20th century, and had as its cornerstone an attempt to sort of return to the sources of medieval Jewish philosophy as expressed in Arabic by writers like Sadia Gaon and Maimonides, and to turn away from the Kabbalah, from the Jewish mystical tradition. And so they had a very antagonistic relationship towards Kabbalah, which had been a staple of Judaism in Yemen. And so these three men interacted with the courts were able to interact with the courts in a way that was more they were conversant in the language of the courts in a way that most other people were not. But they also had a lot of money to pay, because going to court then, as now, was an expensive and so they were able to sort of pursue what seemed like relatively small or trivial or selfish type of matters in court, just by virtue of having had the money to do so.
So since you've mentioned the Kabbalah, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the You tell a very interesting story in the book about the conflict over the Kabbalah and the reading of the Zohar and how that pulls in the Muslim authorities even up to the level of Imam Yahya. Could you tell us a little bit more about that story?
Sure. So there were two factions, and there's the Dorda faction, which is identified with a particular rabbi named Yahya Kafeh, and the Kabbalistic faction, which is identified with another rabbi who was each of them had been the chief rabbi. The other rabbi was Yahya Ishaq. At a certain point, Yahya Kafeh, the rabbi, starts launching a very pointed criticism of Kabbalah as being idolatrous and in its doctrine of the mystical, the spherot, or the various essences or emanations of God, that it's essentially polytheistic and even Christian. And also railing against certain practices that are associated with Kabbalism, like whether or not the table should be cleared after the blessing after meals, or or whether or not certain words should be used in canonical prayers. A host of very small litmus tests, essentially, that differentiated the two groups. And this split between the Kabbalists and the anti-Kabbalists became quite bitter, very bitter, very fast, and often led to violence. And the two groups were not shy about trying to draw the Muslim authorities into this debate. The anti-Kabbalists did everything that they could to try to portray their enemies as polytheists, right? As not like that the belief in these Kabbalistic doctrines was so foreign to the monotheism of Judaism that these people essentially were should not be considered Jews by the Muslim state. Now, that was the implication of a lot of their arguments, or very incendiary arguments. But they were the minority. So on the other hand, they're probably a third of the community in Sana'a. The Kabbalists were saying these people are introducing, you know, innovation into Judaism. They are making changes in something that has been this way for centuries and is as it should be. So they're troublemakers, and they are agents of foreign powers. This was the way that they were presented to the authorities by the Kabbalists. So everybody was trying to each side within the Jewish this intra-Jewish controversy was trying to get the Muslims to crack down on the other side, which they tried not to do, it seems. And I argue that. That then as now in Yemen there's a real problem with sectarian identity and trying to manage the for any government to try to manage the differences between Zaydi Shiites and Shafi Sunnis, who made up the bulk of the population of the South, was always a huge, very delicate balancing act. And Imam Yahya tried with some success, although some limited success, to try to keep those tensions to a minimum. And it seems that he was doing the same thing when it came to the Jewish community. He saw the two situations as being analogous. And and therefore even though the Zaydi tradition takes a pretty dim view of Sufis, that is a mysticism within Islam, because his interest was in keeping things quiet and calm, the tendency on the part of the government was to back the Kabbalist side.
That's really interesting. So on one hand, we have these really important matters of Jewish law ending up in an Islamic court, but there also seem to be more mundane matters that are adjudicated there. And you tell a really fascinating anecdote about Al-Jamal buying a bicycle and how that ends him in this prolonged legal battle of, in a way. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. There's a document called the Pact of Omar, which is was allegedly written right at the outset of Islam by some Christians in Syria, outlining the various conditions under which they would live in an Islamic state. And it contains various stipulations, and there are various versions of it. But in general, the rules that are detailed in the Pact of Omar are meant to emphasize through clothing and various ways, manners of behavior, the superiority of Muslims over non-Muslims. So one of the stipulations of the Pact of Omar has to do with riding animals. So a non-Muslim is not supposed to ride a horse, because if they do ride some sort of animal, like a donkey, they should ride side saddle. And if they ride side saddle, they still should not pass. If they're riding an animal, they shouldn't pass a Muslim on the right. So it's various sort of etiquette of travel. And what to do when various points relating to travel and traveling on animals. And this was apparently in Yemen a very fraught area. And Muslims and Jews would often, seems from reading the memoirs, it seems that that was a particularly problematic moment when a Jew mounted on an animal encountered a Muslim. Because the Jew was meant to behave in a certain way, but in many instances it was not practical, or it might have been in a part of the country where like a rural area where those rules were not observed in the way that they were in cities. So different Jews tried to challenge these regulations in various ways. So presumably some Jews, did what they were expected to do, which would be to dismount and say something, before proceeding with their donkey, past a Muslim. But other Jews did not, and other Jews really tried to try to see how far they could push it, and that's what two of these Salim Sayyid al-Jamal and also Salah al-Dahri did this at various points. So they would say, well, if I can't buy a horse, what if I got just an absolutely incredible donkey, right? And so there was this certain breed of white donkey with a very loud voice, a very powerful, impressive looking donkey. So they would get that, and then they would find in the legal discussions, well, it's really riding side saddle is really something you only need to do if you have an actual saddle. But if you were to just put like a fancy saddle cloth on the animal, or even ride without a saddle at all, you could ride it in the normal way. So you have people trying to push the envelope, Jews trying to push the envelope with donkeys in this way. And then in 1931, Salim Sayyid al-Jamal gets the idea, well, what about a bicycle, right? It doesn't say anything. We have these, they had just become available, and he's an importer, so he presumably has has access to them before almost anyone else. So he says, well, it doesn't say anything about bicycles, so I'm gonna, you know. So he gets one and he starts riding it around, and he starts this legal battle that takes years and years, drags on for years and years, where he goes to the courts, essentially asking for a bicycle license, using various stratagems as to why he needs a bicycle and what he's going to do with it. And he says in his memoirs that he was really trying to use the bicycle as a kind of wedge issue to undermine all of these sumptuary laws, all of the various laws ranging from, you know, whether or not a Jew could ride a horse or a donkey or a bicycle, but also whether or not it was appropriate for a Jew to raise his or her voice in the presence of a Muslim, or dress in a certain fashion, or wear their hair in a certain way that distinguished them from Muslims.
So would you say this is really about pushing reform, or even what would amount to a civil rights agenda in our language?
Yeah, I mean, he presents it that way, and it's hard to know how much of this was, how much of this is a kind of retrospective self-presentation. But certainly, I think it's fair to say that that these intermediaries that I talk about in the book, these men who had become very successful, were very highly educated and wealthy. It really irritated them, and it really bothered them that they, to have it sort of pushed in their faces that they were not equal to the Muslims who had similar, that there was a threshold of status that they could not reach by virtue of the fact that they were Jews. So whether or not he was doing it whether or not they were doing this out of vanity as a broader attempt to sort of pave the way for the entire community is hard to say. Certainly when you can make the case that, that a lot of similar struggles have their origins in a similar sort of tension, and that what is essentially selfish can in the end after it plays out through the courts and through the legal system can end up improving the lot of others. But Al-Jamal he presents himself very much in the mold of a kind of civil rights attorney who engineers these provocations to the Sharia courts in the hopes of creating a breaking a hole wide enough that all the entire Jewish community can follow behind him. Others like Salah al-Dahari, I think, is much more cynical about the system, and I guess it's important to remember that that the system operated in a variety of ways that were laid out in legal sources, and also ways that you won't find detailed in any kind of legal sources. So there was a lot of bribery that went on. There were a lot of within the legal system in Yemen, there were a lot of non-legal factors that, and this is one of the things that I tried to elicit in my book, is that these non-legal factors having to do with the political outlook of judges, or the kind of interpersonal relationships between litigants and judges, or lawyers and litigants, often these had as much, if not more, to do with the outcome of cases than what the law said or what one would think would be the allowable room of interpretation for the given judge.
So it it sounds like that their wealth and their prominence was actually what allowed them to play this role. And it makes me wonder if somehow the Jewish success in commerce in Yemen also was threatening to the status quo of Muslim superiority in some way.
It was, and it's hard to say. I should say that the successes of this very small group of new kind of mercantile elite in Yemen came at the expense of the decline of a very large segment of various artisans and practitioners of industries, Jewish and Muslim, who were essentially being driven out by the introduction of mass-produced goods and industrialization. So, in a sense, so we have at the same time we have the rise of these handful of very, you know, very wealthy individuals. There are also quite a few, a much larger number of Jews and Muslims who were unable to practice crafts because their crafts have become obsolete. There's no longer there isn't the market for the kind of handmade shoes and tobacco, cigarettes, and silver filigree, and the whole range of things that Jews were involved in before the country was opened up to mass produced imports. Certainly there was a perception that that imams favored these or that these Jewish merchants who were in this new elite had enjoyed a kind of favoritism on behalf of the imams that Muslims did not, and that certainly stoked resentment of the Jewish community.
Given the change you're talking about from an economy based on craft to one based on imports, I'd imagine that there was also a lot of inter-Jewish class resentment. Is that the case?
Definitely. And you even find one Jew who was from Sana'a who later emigrated to Israel and then came back to Yemen as an agent of the for the Jewish agency. He wrote very bitterly about these kind of operators, these Jewish operators who were wealthy and could work the system in the courts and were well connected with the imams and the imams' sons and the judges and other people. And he was extremely distrustful of them. And he said that everybody else was as well, and that they had these, they didn't care the way that they ought to about the broader community, the Jewish community, and that they essentially had, one of their main roles was providing alcohol to the imams and their entourages, or not the imams so much as their other members of the royal family, because alcohol is forbidden in Islam, as you know, but Jews were allowed to make alcohol and often sold alcohol to Muslims, so they sort of had this. They had this essential role as providers of contraband and also illicit goods, perfume and imported goods and other things that they could get from Europe that the royal family wanted.
Alcohol seems to have been a particular area of sensitivity and seems to lead sometimes to collective punishment of the Jewish community. I wonder how that collective punishment plays out, and also what that says maybe about sort of individual rights versus collective rights in this legal system?
Well, yeah, there, again, when it came to alcohol, the alcohol is not permitted in Islam, but it's necessary to the observance of Judaism. So the Islamic State allowed Jews to make alcohol with the assumption that they would make it only for their own consumption. Yemen is also a place that where grapes grow quite well, and so has winemaking traditions that you can already find attested in pre-Islamic Arabic poetry. But there were various attempts by imams to crack down on, because there was always an incentive for Jews to Jews could make alcohol, and there were Muslims who wanted to drink it, and so there was always it was expensive. So there was always a temptation for Jews to sell alcohol to Muslims, and usually a way for that to happen. And so the Jewish quarter becomes a kind of red light district of sorts already in the Ottoman period, where Muslims are trying to get a hold of alcohol and even stronger things in the Ottoman period, and the government wants to crack down on it, but isn't quite sure how. So collective punishment is one of the ways in which they, one of the methods that they try. So someone is caught selling wine to a Muslim, their house is destroyed. Later, once the conflict between the Dordea anti-Kabbalists and the Kabbalists heats up, there is, of course, that finds its way into this system of monitoring the Jewish quarter as well. So where Kabbalists don't trust the anti-Kabbalists to report accurate information to the government, and fully expect them to, you know, try to turn in the other group. Each group expects the other group to try to turn them in and have them be the victim of these collective punishments. So there's a wall that's built around the Jewish quarter, really, and according to some accounts, but at the behest of the chief rabbi, and various checkpoints where policemen search the bags of merchants who are coming and going from the Jewish quarter to check for alcohol. So, you know, in the course of trying to crack down on alcohol, the government has to become more and more involved in its production, even getting into questions that you wouldn't think that they would get into, like quality control, making sure that individual winemakers are not using too much sugar when they're making their wine, or even making sure that all alcohol meets a certain or all wine has a certain minimum standard of alcohol, 16%, which is quite strong.
Given all this tension, how common was violence between Muslims and Jews in Yemen?
Well, I'm not sure I say, you know, how common it was in terms of I'm not sure we have the kind of data that one would need in order to answer that with any confidence, but certainly the sources describe quite a few violent altercations between Muslims and Jews, which is something that you would not expect, or certainly something that I did not expect before I had seen it, because for Muslims, in addition to the system of Islamic law that is prevails in Yemen. There are also various tribal norms, and to to attack a Jew is sort of on par with striking a woman. It's just not direct violence towards the weakest members of society is considered a terribly unmanly thing to do within that tribal ethos. So one would expect not to find it that often, but we do find instances of violence, and more surprising, I suppose, than Muslims occasionally, getting into having fights, starting fights with Jews. We also find Jews starting fights with Muslims, which is, I think, even harder to explain. They face, in terms of the way the courts are organized, the testimony of a Jewish witness is not worth the testimony of a Muslim witness. So it would seem to be an awfully risky thing to do. But we do find quite a few examples or anecdotes of Jews starting fights with Muslims.
You tell a really fascinating story about al-Dahri essentially beating up a qadi. I wonder if you could go through that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a wonderful and quite complicated story about which begins as a domestic dispute between a Jewish couple. Where a Jewish woman from Sana'a is married to another Jew who she considers a real kind of hick and doesn't have the manners that she would expect in a man, and so she walks out on him and she finds and she basically. Take shelter in the house of a qadi from Sana'a, so a Muslim qadi from Sana'a. And so this is extremely embarrassing to the Jewish husband, and he enlists the help of one of these Jewish intermediaries, Salah al-Dahri, to get the woman back. So on some level, this is the story of a Jew, a group of Jewish men trying to rein in a rebellious Jewish woman. But in the process, this group of Jewish men go over to the Qadi's house, they get into the Qadi doesn't want to turn her over to them, and they get into a big fight in the courtyard, and the qadi sustained some blows to the head. In the remainder of the story, you find the sort of facts of the story are seem to be pretty bad for the Jews. You have Muslim witnesses to the Jews having beat up this qadi, who is a person of high social standing and so on, but despite all this, the way that the story plays out, the men who beat up the qadi managed to get away with it, basically by initiating a very complicated kind of sting operation on some of the Muslim witnesses who presumably had been paid to exaggerate the extent of the man's injuries, and by forging some documents relating to the extent of his injuries, and behind all this, you see that there and in doing all this, the Jews who basically succeed in beating the man up and then escaping any kind of punishment for it all of their legal bills and expenses are being handled by a Muslim rival, a very powerful Muslim rival of the Qadis. So there are all these sort of interacting circles of violence individual players end up siding with people making unlikely alliances, essentially. And it all comes together in such a way that Salah al-Dahri is able to claim this as his kind of his great shining moment, almost in a way, in the same way that Salam Sayyid al-Jamal is able to claim his bike rides through the Muslim neighborhoods of Sana'a as his his victory in achieving parity with the most powerful Muslims in Yemen.
What I think is really fascinating about that story is how it shows these Jews and Muslims as part of networks that really cross religious lines, right? And that it's not just about religion, that's one aspect, but also class and regional identity and all these other aspects come into it.
Definitely, yeah. That's definitely the case where you find and often it changes depending on the situation. So you find Jews, for example, in certain circumstances and in certain contexts they identify with the Sayyids, that is the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad who theoretically anyway occupy the highest rung of the social hierarchy. And in other situations, as the need arises, they identify with the lowest status Muslims of them all, the Dawashin or the black caste of Muslims that that one finds sort of on the margins of Yemeni society. These are some of the non-legal realities. These are some of the various codes that are being manipulated by the players within these legal dramas.
It's kind of amazing that those cross-religious alliances still come through, given that these are memoirs largely written much later in the Israeli context, where obviously there's tension between Muslims and Jews. So I wonder if you could just say a bit about the fact that these are memoirs and how you related to these sources, and maybe how, if they were problematic for that reason.
Yeah, there was a variety of sources. So the sources in Arabic, the Muslim sources, can be problematic in that they tend only to talk about learned Muslim men. So in the sense that the anecdotes that I discuss or the episodes I discuss largely involve Jews and ordinary people, I'll only be able to use those sources, such as biographical dictionaries or and so on, to talk about the judge or the important political figures who are involved. And then when it comes to various like manuals of Islamic law, the manuals of law, they talk about the law as it should be, what should happen. They don't talk about what does happen or what did happen. So often you get a very idealized picture of the legal system as a whole. And one of the things I enjoyed about writing this book was finding out the discrepancy between how things ought to be and how they actually were, in surprising ways, in all manner of surprising ways. And then the memoirs, which gave so much life to these anecdotes, are interesting for a variety of reasons, because In most cases, the people who wrote these memoirs are published them at their own expense, and they were not, you know, by and large, they were not writers. They're not, they're just ordinary people Ratzon Halevi, who wrote some wonderful memoirs, was a construction worker in Tel Aviv. Mm. Met him once before he died, and he gave me these books, and that was one of my first exposure to this material. But they are talking quite a bit about. It is interesting, as you say, that they have their audience is primarily other Yemenite Jews in Israel. But they do focus on these dramatic anecdotes, and I should say that I largely used many of these books have a sort of very radical break between part one and part two, right? Part one being life in Yemen, and then part two being once they arrived in Israel. And my right. focus was on the earlier part. Although I think there is something to be said for the way in which they, you know, have tried to harmonize those two experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think even just the outlining their Zionism is kind of interesting because they in some way project it back into Yemen. Maybe they were Zionists in Yemen, but maybe that's also exaggerated by their new context.
That's true. Yeah. I think that is the case. And I think, I think there is also I certainly suspect that, certainly when some of the writers who talk about the kind of the intense poverty and just the epidemics and poverty and just very grim conditions that prevailed in Yemen for everybody in the 40s. I wonder whether the sort of ideological fervor that gets projected back into that period is whether it's apologetic or if they, how much of their motivations for leaving were driven by that a simple desire to get away from that situation.
Great. I think we've taken up too much of your time. Thanks a lot. We usually conclude just by asking what you're working on now.
I'm in Paris now, and I'm working with a colleague on a collection of poems from 18th century Yemen, written by a Muslim author called Al-Khafanji, who wrote humorous poems in Yemeni vernacular Arabic. So they're very interesting on a variety of levels. It's a very large corpus of Arabic vernacular literature from the 18th century, which is earlier than we're accustomed to dating the emergence of vernacular literature in Arabic, but it's a very rich manuscript tradition, and Khafanji does a lot of interesting things with language, with experimenting with the various kinds of types of language that different people in Yemen at that time used, and what's germane to our conversation is that he does have Jewish characters, which he introduces for comic effect, and he tries to imitate the way that they talk and the way that they incorporate Hebrew words and other strange expressions into their speech, and he even goes so far as to describe his own process of writing poetry as being, akin to a Jew preparing for the Sabbath, which is supposed to be very quite hilarious.
That sounds like an awesome project. I look forward to seeing it. Thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.